Hello and welcome to a PrivCap webinar. I'm David Snow, a partner at PrivCap Media. And today we're joined by a panel of experts who are going to be talking to us all about the connection between the global supply chain and portfolio company operations. We're joined today by Raz Khan of Premira, Mark Yampieri of Alex Partners, and Brian Nemeth, also of Alex Partners. Gentlemen, welcome to PrivCap today. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, David.
Thank you.
I'm really excited about this topic. Obviously, it's in the headlines right now in a big way and in people's lives, whether it's professional or even personal. So I'm fascinated to hear what you all have to say. I'll just kind of throw out the most obvious thousand-foot question. You know, since all of you are on the front lines of portfolio company operations, how have disruptions in the global supply chain affected the ability of private equity-backed portfolio companies to deliver products to customers?
Well, David, I think that's a good way to start our conversation, because I think this is pretty broad based, where the challenges of moving goods internationally impact most companies. My focus primarily is on the North American market, so we're a very large importer from Asia as well as the Americas and Europe. But the trade from Asia to Europe has been a significant challenge. Going back to really the beginning of this year, where there was expectations around, after the end of the holidays, to be a little bit of a slowdown in demand. That didn't happen. Didn't have enough containers. That created a challenge. The supply lines were, slower to get product here. So people compensated by ordering ahead, ordering more, which created more of a challenge. And then as the shutdowns due to COVID cases at manufacturing facilities, at ports, within the transportation industry, it really brought a lot of this flow of goods to, in some cases, a grinding halt. Certainly, there's a cost impact like we've never seen before, with hundreds of percent of cost increases for ocean freight, a significant shift to air freight where appropriate. And so this is, like I said, it's pretty broad based, and it's been a challenge. Few companies have been able to get through this completely unscathed. Certainly some have done better than others, but this is something that I think we're all dealing with as people in business, but also as consumers as well.
Yeah, Mark, the only other thing I would add to that is specific to us, Premira. We invest in companies that have strong underlying growth and are fast growing companies. And so, this has been a real acute issue for us. So, we have underlying growth as well, but then also in some cases have seen huge spikes in demand through COVID. And so all very relevant and acute issues for us.
Great. Well, I'm curious to learn from any of you, what are the root causes of the freight shortages and the cost spikes that everyone's so aware of right now?
Sure, I'm happy to start on that, David. Some of the root causes, by the way, it's broader than freight, it's across the supply chain. Some of the root causes that we're seeing, clearly labor shortages, both in skilled and unskilled labor. I read an article recently where it's being called the Great Resignation, and a lot of people, for one reason or another, either not showing up or changing careers as their initial career path has been disrupted. So that's one. Clearly material shortages specific to us and some companies, resin shortages. We have chip shortages that everyone knows about. Longer lead times across the board with everyone's supply chain disrupted. Lead times are very, very long and getting longer in some cases. Even things as tactical as container shortages. If you can get a container, you're lucky, and we'll pay whatever we need to pay. And so all of that combined, it's a lot of these issues, but then also inflation on top of that, because there are shortages, is leading to an inflationary environment, hugely inflationary in some cases. So those are some of the root causes that we're facing, but they're also, they create opportunities, which we'll talk about in a little bit here.
There's another aspect I'd like to kind of call out is that, we've gone for many, many years where supply has not been significantly interrupted. And in many cases, there's been an oversupply, whether it's for specific services or for, particular goods. And, people are interesting creatures. You know, after things work out well for a year, you nibble a little bit and you try to take a little bit more cost out. You extend the supply chain a little bit further. Make it so fragile that it doesn't take much for it to break. And we absolutely saw it break this year. And those decisions were made by a lot of experienced, educated, intelligent people. But I think the risk profile was probably not evaluated correctly of what the actual cost would be if it would break. In some of those cases, it's catastrophic. If you don't have the one component to complete your finished good, you can't have any sales. And we're seeing that in many industries. The auto one is probably the most visible, but it's certainly impacting other durable goods and consumer products.
Yeah. And I also think there's a point of almost like a pile-on effect of these disruptions, right? Disruptions have been happening, but they've been happening at such a increased frequency, right? If you look at ocean, right, you had COVID, you had shutdowns, large increases of demand, you had a vessel stuck in the Suez, then you had terminals closed in Asia for periods of time, which jammed up supply going through. And now you have vessels waiting outside of ports in China, waiting outside the ports of LA to basically be able to berth to just unload these containers. So this pile-on effect has also just kind of exasperated the whole entire situation.
Well, short question, challenging answer. I'll ask it to all of you. What can companies do to live in this new normal of supply chain disruption, and how can their private equity sponsors help them?
You know, as I mentioned earlier, there's also opportunities. So all of this disruption and the root causes and these issues that we've talked about have really forced us to think differently. So the opportunities and where we're working with our portfolio companies on are, number one, we're thinking about creating vertical structures. So years ago, there was a huge push to only focus on your core competency and outsource everything else. In some cases, we are insourcing. In some cases, we are really thinking about really controlling our vertical supply chain. And, you know, so we have control. And so that's number one. We are paying for and also getting paid for better and reliable, sustainable service. So we're creating partnerships, versus simply just beating up your suppliers on squeezing every penny. We're really going looking for great partners, and which, by the way, fits into Primera's values perfectly. So partnership, creativity, integrity, and really creating long-term partnerships with our suppliers and paying them for the service that they provide. And in turn, we get paid by our customers for the sustainable service that we provide, the reliable, sustainable service. Those are a couple of the examples. And then also, in a lot of cases, we're just not tolerating what we would tolerate before. So where there are substandard suppliers, et cetera, we're not going to deal with those. We're going to focus on the really good ones where and develop long-term relationships. And also, this is a huge opportunity for us to simplify our businesses in most cases, simplify supply chains, but also businesses where there was maybe some reluctance or hesitance in the past to rationalize products. We're doing that now, rationalize suppliers. We're doing that now, in some cases, even rationalize customers and really go after the, when you have, it's all about supply and demand. And, we want to invest in the best customers, best suppliers, best supply chains. So it's been a huge, huge opportunity to also simplify the businesses and drive value. The last thing I'll say is decoupling. Wherever we can decouple, we're also doing that, whether it be manufacturers or suppliers or supply chains, to basically not have single points of failures anymore and have a lot of sustainable but repetitive supply chain. So I'll stop there and see if the others want to comment.
Yeah, I think those are all great points. And I think we're seeing a lot of similar things from the Alex side. I could tell you tactically, there's kind of some short-term and long-term focus areas we've seen. One of the big things is, having supply chain front and center, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and having kind of all different functions understanding what's happening is a unique situation. Usually supply chain and operations sometimes falls in the background. So I think there's a really unique opportunity to pass costs through, right? Everybody understands what's going on right now. So on a short-term solution, working with companies to say, hey, you've seen that freight's increased, or you've seen that raw materials have increased. We need to pass this along. Everyone has to absorb their share. So that's one tactic that's obviously been high on people's list. The other is kind of the alternate suppliers, companies you might not have considered using before. You know, nothing's off the table anymore. I think everyone is all about being creative and finding solutions here. I think the fourth area is really planning, right? Like, you used to buy an MOQ worth of a purchase order. Maybe you actually only need half of that purchase order and half of another purchase order. How do you find smart ways to be able to understand how you can consolidate or break up the product to get what you actually need versus maybe what you want? And then the other thing we're seeing short-term is communication is a huge deal, right? Internally, across functions, but also with suppliers and customers, just being as transparent as possible so people understand what you're going through. And a lot of people are going through the same, but communication these are the short-term tactical things. And I think long-term, there's a few others, but I think the most interesting that's been across people's mind or a question we get asked the most is about diversification and nearshoring. And I think that's more of a 12-month to a 2-year exercise. But because of what's happening, companies are starting to take a much more serious look than they have historically is, hey, maybe I should ship my manufacturing or a portion or a subset of my manufacturing to Mexico instead of Asia so I can handle these disruptions as I see them coming more often.
Companies need a plan. And that plan is an immediate term plan, near-term plan, and obviously the long-term. In the immediate term, there is so much uncertainty that we've seen more and more of our clients and other companies embrace the concept of a short-term control tower for aspects of the business that are acutely suffering from a pain point, whether it's supply disruption or it's cost or what have you. And it's temporary, and it's to kind of weather the storm. A lot of the things that we're seeing here, we don't expect to be this challenging indefinitely, but certainly could go in, you know, for another 6 to 12 months. And so it's something that needs to be addressed now, but not permanent. And then with the medium-term plan, the team here hit on it, alternate network models are really becoming top of the list of things to look at. And we have to challenge the way we've done things, because historically it was, like I mentioned before, a significant amount of supply, in many cases oversupply. And so we can just put our eggs in one basket and it's fine. All of my supply comes from one country in Asia is a very risky proposition. How many companies trading at high multiples now have done that and now are paying the price? It's a lot more than I think we would have expected if we asked that question 3 years ago.
Raz, you mentioned, you know, it's not the style of your firm to beat up on a supplier or, you know, to kind of use that metaphor. But in these more challenging times, talk about what it looks like in practice when certain partners, certain suppliers maybe are not stepping up to the plate or not being as communicative as they need to be versus others that are really stepping up with an innovative and a flexible mindset. You know, what does that look like without naming names necessarily from your perspective?
It's really about understanding and data. And, you know, so number one, getting into discussions with them. I don't believe there's a single supplier that we deal with that wants to be difficult. And it's really trying to understand what their situation is and how do we help them as well. So there are certain suppliers, parties, et cetera, that, you know, have solved their problems in a creative way. There are others that are struggling with one thing or another, whether it be geography, you know, where they're located or that specific, you know, if there's a certain variant going on over there, et cetera, or, you know, their suppliers that are struggling, whatever it is. So we really try to understand. It is not our style. It is not the firm. It's not our style to beat up on anyone. We really want to be collaborative. So that starts with really understanding and then going through the data. You know, and part of it is, you know, the data is what are our forecasts that we're giving to them? So how good are we at communicating to our suppliers, whether they be great or they're struggling? So it's really, it takes time, but we want, we want them to be successful because we want them and we need them to be successful because our success is tied to their success. So, no, I don't think that there's any value in beating them up. It's really about a partnership and trying to figure out how do we collaboratively and collectively solve the problems.
Raz, you used a term earlier that I really like, and you know, I think some people may be sensitive to it, which is, you know, we're not going to be tolerant of waste, and we're not going to be tolerant of people making decisions that create an inefficient system. And I think, you know, with the right data and with things being so dynamic, you've got to look at your suppliers, you've got to look at your customers, and you look at the entire supply chain. Where are the areas of inefficiency? And then what can we do about it to make the whole system more efficient? And then we can negotiate on who gets to share an equal or larger portion of that value. But that has to happen on a much more frequent basis than the annual contract review or even a QBR, I would argue in some cases. And that's definitely an area where you're not beating up anyone. You're really working together collaboratively to reduce the cost overall.
The last point on that one is the nature of, when I look at the transportation piece instead of the supplier thing, it's transportation is cyclical, right? And the transportation companies are in a unique position that they haven't been in for almost the last decade or so. But you know, how a shipper is treated today by a carrier, you know, they remember and vice versa. And so I think there's been opportunities, you know, the big companies are being taken care of by the big companies, but I think you have opportunities to work with smaller transportation providers, medium ones that really are interested in obtaining new businesses and obtaining new partnerships. And they're taking advantage of this. And this is some of the areas where you kind of see better service levels through, you know, through finding the right partner.
And I'd like to dive into a topic that is central to the supply chain question, which is all about the conventional rules of inventory. How have those changed, and how do portfolio companies and their private equity backers need to be flexible with regard to, you know, the inventory rules that perhaps everyone learned in business school that now seem to have been blown apart?
Yeah, this one is really interesting. As you said, the business school rules are you never want to tie up any more cash in inventory than you absolutely have to. And that still is true, although we never want to miss a sale either. And, you know, so as growth investors and people that love our customers and care about our customers and what their needs are, we never want to miss that sale. We want to have our products and services ready when our customers want them. So for that, we have now started building more inventory than you normally would build. So we would rather have, you know, more cash tied up in good inventory than miss the sales. Now, I'm very careful to say, use the word good inventory, because not all inventory is good inventory. So although the basic rules have not changed, how we apply them have changed. And, you know, so what we're doing now is on, you know, number one, real stratification of what the products and also the raw materials look like. So, you know, really understanding the A, B, C items, and on the A's and B's, never running out of stuff. And on other stuff, you know, but then, you know, being very careful on what we buy and how we buy, but then also on WIP. So the work in process inventory is stuff, you know, in some cases didn't get enough attention. Now it's getting a lot of attention. Where is the cash stuck? So whether it be in the supply chain, whether it be in manufacturing, and really going deep into where is that stuck? Because that not only is it tying up cash, but it's also preventing us getting that finished product to the customers. So I don't think the rules have changed. We're just differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that that focus on flexible inventory, whether it's things that can be built modularly and you focus on the top components, focus on raw materials, focus on keeping product closer to the production site if you produce in market, because there's so much uncertainty where that demand's coming from next. Forward deploying finished goods across your SKU portfolio and all the markets is a recipe for markdowns and for other issues. So I agree with Raz 100%.
I do also. I think when I think about the work we do, the talk about the right SKUs, that's been one of the things most in demand on our side with our clients is, you know, which are the SKUs that are generating the most revenue, which are generating the most profit, which are generating traffic, whether it's foot traffic or online traffic, but really understanding that SKU base to make sure that the investment's in the right spot. It's just become commonplace for us these days.
I'd love any kind of anecdotes around, examples of flexibility in solving complex problems as a result of the supply chain disruption. Anything having to do with maybe substituting parts, if one widget, you know, isn't available, you use another one. Anything from your portfolios?
Yeah, so I've got a couple examples but I'll share one. When looking at a complex manufactured and assembled good, there's a whole universe of suppliers that you need to work with and kind of orchestrate all the supply coming in at the right time, given the move over the years to the just-in-time manufacturing that we have here, at least in North America. There is substitution from different suppliers of effectively the same component, which is a little bit easier if they're already pre-qualified. And so again, with that one, you would have to have pre-qualified them. There's also the opportunity to fast track the design process to potentially qualify a supplier that is a little bit different, has a slightly different approach. And then there's the third one, which is a little bit harder. And in years past, this could have taken up to a year to do, but we've seen out of necessity to not miss a sale and to get these goods finished, approving spec changes, approving design changes a lot faster. Granted, there's probably some element of risk in doing so, but there's a significant element of risk if you stop selling your goods, period. And so that is one area where we've definitely seen it from the supply side. And on the sales side, on the customer side, this is really where we've talked a lot about the supply chain. The sales force can be very helpful in educating the customer and bringing them along into substituting into other finished goods that you have that will accomplish the need. And quite honestly, that's all that you have available. And relying on them to support that, I think, is also a very important aspect of this.
And another creative exercise that we've seen that's also been in the news is basically big companies are chartering vessels to get space, right? They're taking a hold of their own supply chain. You've seen Walmart and Home Depot, and I think Costco announced today, really literally chartering vessels to bring their own product in. And even on the transportation side, there was news, I think today or yesterday, of a owner of bulk vessels that's reclassing their vessels just to handle containers. So yeah, these are things you never would have thought of a year ago, a year and a half ago. And now they're becoming kind of the topic of the day or a new trend, for lack of a better way to describe it.
The only anecdote I would add, David, is that, similar to what Mark described on the Salesforce helping, where we had product lines with long tails and long life cycle in terms of when it would get rationalized, those things got rationalized pretty quickly. So, and so our sales forces have really been helping and been on the forefront of driving the conversion to the new products, where the conversion was hard previously, they helped move onto the new because we had to simplify and we had to rationalize. And in some cases, those older products, just nobody was making, not just us, but our suppliers weren't supporting them, et cetera. So it's been a huge opportunity as well to then basically focus on the new versus the old long tail life cycle ones.
Have any of you had conversations very recently with people in the shipping business? I mean, what's it like out there? Any war stories that you've been told, or, what's the general attitude?
I don't know if you're in the business of moving freight, I don't know if I'd call it a war story. I would call it the best year ever, the best quarter ever. the sound of corks popping out of champagne bottles is deafening right now. And what we're seeing is companies are producing profits that they haven't produced cumulatively in decades. And so they're now very quickly getting their strategy teams together of, how do we lock this down? And maybe they don't hold on to the highest price that's out there in the marketplace. We wouldn't expect that. But if you're able to produce profits that are double or triple of what you've been able to do over the last 10 years, and you think you can lock them down for a couple of years, that's where the focus should be. And quite honestly, that's where the focus is. And so extension of contracts that were quarterly, annual to multi-year, they're coming your way.
The other call out, right, was the announcement, and in a way, I mean, they've announced they're no longer going to increase rates, a few container lines, right? It's kind of capped off in a way. So that's another signal to the market, right, that we've kind of achieved the peak. We might stay at that peak for a little bit, but you know, this is kind of as high as it goes. I think two of the top five carriers have already signaled, right, this is it. We're capping it here, and we're going for image control of not gouging the marketplace. And at the same thing, to echo what Mark said, right, is how do I now capture this for as long as possible, whatever financial benefit I could get here.
What are you seeing specifically in the healthcare industry by way of, I guess, supply shortages? Raz, do you work with healthcare companies, and has that been an issue that you are involved with?
Yes, I do work with a lot of our healthcare companies. We're an active healthcare investor, and we have a number of portfolio companies in the space. The shortages are much like everything else. So, you know, certainly on the shipping, et cetera, so getting our products in, getting our products out has been an issue. But then more specifically, you know, number one, not only just the companies, but also the regulators. So we have twofold concerns on the healthcare side, and both are backed up. So it's much harder to basically flex the supply chain. You know, in other industries, if one supplier cannot solve your problem, then you go to a second one and you can make those shifts fairly quickly. In healthcare, those are all process revalidation. So that is a longer, and you know, you need your quality team, you need the regulatory team, and then in some cases you have to go back to the regulators. So whomever asks the question clearly understands the complexities. So it's been more difficult, but also those are the moats around the businesses also, is that nobody else can then just jump in and start doing what you're doing. But it's across the board. We've had raw material issues. We've had, you know, whether it be castings, forgings, we've had suppliers that are performing coating. That's been issues. There have been issues there as well. And then also in, getting just the raw materials for if you're making a drug substance or a drug product. Even in some cases, we've had issues getting vials to basically fill the finished product in. So it's been across the board, whether it be transportation or chemicals to create the substance or the vials to fill the actual finished product into. We're seeing it across the board. And it's just a little bit harder to switch suppliers because you have to go through the whole process revalidation again. But this is where the strategic partnerships really help, right? This is where, you know, and this is where we're seeing it a lot, is really locking in supply and partnerships over a longer term.
Yeah, the other thing I'll add is that, as Raz said, you know, the approval process is certainly a barrier, and it puts even more value on having more diverse supply base. We all can appreciate that has a impact to cost. But if we expect things to be volatile over the next several years, I think that might be a very worthwhile trade-off to have geographic, separation between certain suppliers, as well as, you know, substitutes with exactly the specifications that could work for the application. Less so in pharmaceutical, but more in some of the equipment and disposables, consumables. Having some flexibility there it's more valuable these days.
And last thing I'd add, that it's also, again, a huge opportunity for us and our companies, where we have been a reliable supplier, and in some cases ramped up extremely fast. So, you know, where we participated in Project Warp Speed, et cetera. And, those customers are here to stay for a long term because they view us as reliable partners as well. And, so it's we've had disruption, but also opportunity to really set ourselves apart as well. Our companies have done a fantastic job of setting themselves apart and really being partners to their customers.
What will you be following to look for signs of a recovery? What forms of data, information, and what are you seeing so far?
From my standpoint, I think there's some very tactical when I look at transportation, right? First, it started with, can I even get on a vessel? Then it quickly moved to, can I get a container? And now we're currently at a point where there's a bunch of vessels that are anchored out at sea waiting to be able to basically access a berth to unload their containers. And so that's something that I would be following. It's obviously impossible to predict when this whole thing will end, but seeing record setting vessels at our anchorage in Southern California, I think there's 70 plus vessels where normally it's none or a handful at most. Watching that is something I'd keep an eye on. The other thing is how long are things staying at the port? Because that indicates two things. One, it's the congestion, but it's also when our warehouse is ready to receive that product. Is there labor? I think, Raz, you talked about that, right? But labor accessibility, you know, it's great if you have 10 containers at the port, but if you only have four warehouse people, you can't unload all 10 of them right away. So turn times at the terminals, watching, you know, how many vessels are waiting to berth. These are the types of indicators to keep an eye on, and hopefully they're moving in the right direction. But in regards to predicting when all this will end, I think that's you need a crystal ball for that one.
I would also challenge those that made predictions last year that, you know, many got it wrong and it was maybe wishful thinking that things would be better sooner. I think the best approach here is to have a couple different scenarios modeled out of here's what we're prepared to do if this outcome occurs 6 months from now. Here's what we're prepared to do if this one occurs, and be ready to do it and be quick to pivot. And, you know, even if, you know, we can get 100 experts to kind of all agree on a date, there's still no guarantee. And, you know, the best course of action is to be prepared for that, in addition to things continuing to remain the same or deteriorate even further.
Yeah, the only other thing I would add is certainly don't have a crystal ball. For me, it's really the people. That's what I'm looking for. To me, that's the number one indicator, both skilled, unskilled, you know, labor, engineers, whatever else it is. And Brian mentioned it. In some cases, we don't have people in warehouses. Some cases, we don't have engineers. We don't have, huge opportunity. We're a great employer. So come find us. That's what we're looking for.
Brian, give us a sense of, I think we've been talking a lot about container ships. How about U.S. rail congestion? What does that look like? What effect is it having?
Yeah, you hear about port congestion. If you talk to any of the terminal operators, they're all going to say, I'm congested because the railroads aren't moving their containers off my property. So that is a huge issue. There's rail congestion at every major terminal. I mean, most recent news is Chicago, the greater Chicagoland. You know, you have product that would have typically moved rail that's being trucked in order to get there. So I think rail is a huge unlock right now on the port congestion, which would actually also help all those vessels that are waiting the berth, right? If the port can operate more smoothly, then those vessels can come in, more containers can get unloaded quicker. So I think the rail congestion, getting exports are down is one of the reasons, or the drivers of this congestion, right? There's not as much moving out. It's all moving out from the ports, but it's not moving into the ports to get exported out of the United States. So these are challenges also to keep an eye on when we talked back to the previous question on indicators. So
retail inventory, which has been depressed, at what point does this stabilize and become the new normal, or do we expect it to go back to where it was?
Well, I think if you're a retailer, you're really attempting to improve your inventory on your staples, on things that it's okay if it's a little bit late. Really, those that are being impacted the most are those that have a significant portion of seasonal goods. They're extremely perishable. Halloween costumes, November 5th, aren't very interesting. And so they've got to be there in the store now, or you missed it. And there's a season, you know, every month there's something new that's going to come in, whether it's apparel, whether it's, you know, other goods that are, you know, for, you know, the summer versus the winter. And so that is going to be a challenge. However, you know, the concept of disposable income, people want to, you know, participate and still live their lives and have fun and do the things that they used to do, focusing on sort of the no regret type of inventory is key. And, you know, there's a couple recent articles that have hit the news wires in the last week about some of the largest retailers have already placed their bets and they're starting to bolster the inventory. But that's only on a subset of the total assortment. There's plenty of other things they'd like to have. It's just a challenge. So, you know, I think we need to be prepared for not an unlimited supply of goods and you can show up the day before a holiday and do all of your shopping and expect to leave satisfied. You really need to get out there early.
Great. Well, I'm glad you mentioned holidays. First of all, is anyone predicting a Halloween costume shortage? If so, we might have to do it the old-fashioned way with a bedsheet or whatever. But more importantly, what are your thoughts on the upcoming holiday shopping season? Where will there be bright spots? Where will there be coal in the stocking?
Well, I tell you, the bright spots are going to be for those that anticipated these challenges continuing and placed their bets early. And are going to have, you know, some of the goods that are, you know, in demand. I think there's also one potential bright spot for both physical retail operators as well as, you know, e-commerce players, in that the news has already hit, you know, the street, and that there's concerns about not having enough for the holiday season and to get out there early. And hopefully what that will do is it'll put less pressure in the final weeks up, you know, before the holidays and spread some of that demand out. There's limited labor resources at the retail store to even handle the customers coming in. That's a challenge. There's limited labor at the warehouses, even with paying overtime and trying to get temps in. It's a challenge when there's a spike in demand. And so hopefully that will smooth things out. And, you know, perhaps if some of the consumers have a positive outlook that they can have a good season by being a little bit more flexible in substitution and come out early, I think they're going to end the year, you know, satisfied that this wasn't a big bust.
I think that's right. I'd sum it up in two words: preparation and flexibility.
Yeah.
On everyone's part.
Yeah.
So if you haven't started already, we're probably in trouble.
That's right.
Yeah, if you're sourcing from Asia, you're looking at lead times that are double what used to be maybe a 30-day time from shipping it in to 60 days, which already gets you to December 1st. So if you haven't bought it, you're in an extremely tough spot.
Adding to the stress of the holiday season, that's great. Raz, you know, we've all talked about how this disruption is creating a more involved partnership type of conversation between, you know, supplier and distributor or the various parties in the supply chain. How about between private equity sponsor and portfolio company management? Raz, I mean, in difficult times, is this an opportunity to really, bolster that partnership between, the owner of the company and the management that are really partnering with that private equity firm to create value?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's been an evolution, right, over the last year and a half or so now with COVID. You know, we in Primera specifically, you know, we hire great management teams. I'm not saying that others don't, but we hire great management teams and we want them to do their jobs. That was true before, is still true now. Where we've really collaborated is making sure, number one, that they have all the financial resources. So, and where, where we needed to double down and put in more equity to really, fuel the growth, and where we saw huge spikes in demand, we did that. So that's one. And then beyond the capital that we've invested and more than basically in some cases, just really spend a lot of time with myself, my colleagues or in the portfolio team, also our deal teams that actually lead the deals, spend a lot more time with the management teams, really just, toss ideas back and forth and make sure that we have a collective approach to problem solving. And we show our portfolio companies that we're real partners. We're partners, they're partners, and we need each other to succeed. And, so it is a real partnership. And lastly, I'll say that any sort of resource our portfolio companies have wanted, we've been able to provide, and happily so. So whether in some cases, whether they want to come work directly with us, the sponsors, or they want to work with consulting firms. You know, we've done that in many cases. It's been Alex Partners as well, where you know we've said either I don't have the expertise, or you know one of my colleagues doesn't have the expertise, but these guys do. And we've done that in several companies. We're brought in Alex Partners or other consultants, but just make sure that you know we've given every resource that we possibly can to our portfolio company management teams to succeed. And we're seeing it. You know, a lot of our companies are doing fantastic, and you know the demand is there, and also and they're meeting the demand. So it's been in a lot of cases, it's really opened you know some of these doors where there was a little bit of hesitancy in some cases, you know, to ask for help. But you know that's really opened up, and it's really made the partnership better.
Along the same lines, I think more management teams have been willingness or have been open and showed more willingness to accept the help too. I mean, these are unprecedented times in the supply chain world. People haven't experienced this in some cases in their entire careers. And that is a good, you know, not an excuse, but it's a good reason why they should consider getting help from those that have been through it before, through the last cycle or something very similar.
Yeah, Mark, and sorry, one last comment. You just triggered something that our portfolio companies are relying on each other as well. So, you know, that's the other place where we've, you know, we've always held conferences, et cetera, that you know, we would bring them together. But that would be, you know, in the pre-COVID times, that was once a year or once, a, you know, every year and a half or so, and you get them together in some location, which we still want to do some point. But with the, you know, with everyone now remote, you know, they've basically been, we've been doing a lot more, and they've been doing a lot more amongst themselves as well. And just, you know, it's much easier to get on a Zoom versus everyone fly to one location. And, and so our, you know, COOs to COOs and HR leaders to HR leaders all getting together in their own forums and really saying, all right, this is the kind of issue that I have. How do I solve it? What are you doing? And they get a very fast response from three practitioners and you know, and leverage best practices.
That's great. Well, this is obviously a big topic that's not going away anytime soon, but this particular discussion is going to have to come to an end now. Really, thanks to the three of you. Raz Khan from Primera, Mark Yampieri from Alex Partners, and Brian Nemeth also from Alex Partners. We hope to have you back in the future on a similar PrivCap webinar and maybe get an update about what's going on in the world of supply chain and value creation. So thank you very much. And thank you to our partner, Alex Partners, on this webinar, and to everyone who tuned in. And to those of you who find this content later, please enjoy and have a great day.
Like what you hear on the PrivCap podcast? Visit PrivCap.com for more thought leadership interviews, articles, reports, webinars, and more.